What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by two master storytellers. Carlo Rovelli, the theoretical physicist and best-selling author, spoke to Philip Pullman, author of the well-known fantasy series His Dark Materials. And together, they discussed how, from their different fields, physics and fantasy writing, we can understand how our imaginations truly allow us to understand the world we live in. It's a fascinating conversation, and if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for Carlo Rovelli's new book, Helgoland, Making Sense of the Quantum Revolution, in the podcast description. But now, let's go to the episode.
Hello, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared event. I'm your host, Shahid Abari, and today we'll be finding out exactly what kind of explosion you get when world-renowned physicists and writers collide. Now, despite being a novel writer on the one hand and a theoretical physicist on the other, these two thinkers have a great deal in common, not least their interest in world-making, or at least trying to understand world-making. And in our conversation today, we'll be thinking about the connections between quantum physics, philosophy, and literature, among other things. You will, I imagine, know of our two brilliant guests. They are joining us from Canada, Carlo Rovelli. Carlo is a theoretical physicist who has made discipline-transforming contributions to the understanding of science, of space and time. His books, Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, Reality is Not What It Seems, and The Order of Time, are international bestsellers which have been translated into 43 languages and have sold over 2 million copies worldwide. He's currently working in Canada and also directing the Quantum Gravity Research Group of the Centre de Physique Théorique in Marseille, France. He is the author of Helgoland, around which some of our discussion today will orbit. It tells the story of the young physicist Werner Heisenberg and the turning point both in Heisenberg's thinking and Carlo's thinking about the relational nature of existence. Hello, Carlo.
Hello, Shada. Pleasure being here.
And joining us from Oxford, I think, is Philip Pullman. Philip is a much cherished and award-winning author, best known for his Dark Materials series of fantasy novels, which include Northern Lights, The Subtle Knife, The Amber Spyglass, and Lyra's Oxford. And they too have been translated into multiple languages. You may have recently caught the TV adaptation of the novels for BBC One and HBO, now entering a second series. And now there are two volumes of a new trilogy, The Book of Dust, La Belle Sauvage, and The Secret Commonwealth, all works which linger on that slippery, rich terrain between literature, science, and philosophy, and which draw deeply from speculative theories of the cosmos. Hello, Philip.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
Hi there, Philip. Lovely to have you both. In fact, the two of you, Philip and Carlo, you've met before, haven't you, in a more personal capacity without an audience like this. I think it was in Oxford, So tell me, who reached out to who and why did you want to talk to each other?
I have no recollection of how we came out to meet, but I remember that we tried a few times and it was finally when we succeeded in Oxford. And what I remember is a pub, a beer, a lot of talking about literature writing and creating world and science creativity. And we meeting in front of a very strange architectural place where I happened to have given a lecture or something. And then a strong desire of meeting again. But then this was long ago before the last dramatic revolution on Earth, before we all started to living in this virtual world. So it seems so long ago. Do you have better memories?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I can't remember whether I reached out to you or you reached out to me, but we had tried to meet before. And finally, there came a day when you had been lecturing in Oxford and I was living very close by. So we managed to meet up, and we went to the pub, whose name I forget, but it was in Walton Street, near the Blavatnik Centre for Government or something or other. And as Carlo said, we had a beer and we talked about literature, physics, the things that connect us and the things that are difficult to understand or define from both directions. I enjoyed it very much, but it's a shame that we've had to wait till now to come together again. But thank you very much, Intelligence Squared, for making this possible.
Oh, I think we're so delighted to bring you together. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that you both intuited that you had something in common, or you had something to talk to about each other, which I think is going to become very apparent in our discussion. I wonder, Carlo, if we can get started first with Helgoland, your new book. And perhaps, in fact, we could start with the title. What is Helgoland, and why is it important to the story of quantum physics that you want to tell?
Let me start from this. What has attracted me in science, and actually what I do still now find fascinating in science, perhaps could be called with expression that you used before in the introduction, which is world making. What is great in science for me is not the understanding of this particular mechanism of this detail, is this absolutely astonishing capacity that has had science repeatedly in the centuries of changing it completely our worldview, our vision of the world. And this has happened many times, has happened in antiquity when people realized that, the earth is not just something with a sky on top, but is a little stone that floats in the middle of the sky. It has happened with the Copernican revolution. It has happened with Darwin. It has happened with Einstein. And every time, it's like a complete change of what the world is, in fact. We just keep changing our view of the world. And perhaps the latest or the greatest even of these huge revolutions, quantum mechanics, quantum theory. And quantum theory has started in a place by a single person, because, many people collaborate to create the possibility of something, but then it's usually one person that snaps. And quantum physics started on the island of Helgoland. That's the title of the book. The title of the book is the name of the island where quantum revolution started. And there was one guy, in fact, a young kid. It was 23, Werner Heisenberg, in solitude, who had the key idea that changed completely the way we think about the world today with respect to what was before. The notion of what matter is, the constituent of reality, in fact, what reality itself is different after what he has found out, which has worked fantastically. I mean, all our technology is based on quantum mechanics. So that's why Helgoland is a point of, I would say, of the greatest revolution in our understanding of the world of the last millennium.
And what can you spell out for people who may not know, what is it that Heisenberg realizes at Helgoland?
Oh, that's not easy. It takes a full book to try to explain it. because quantum mechanics, it's the basics of modern physics, right? And it's used for computers, for lasers, for all sorts of things, for atomic physics, of course, for understanding the basis of chemistry of the galaxy. So it's a core of modern physics. And it's actually how the wave, it replaces basic Newtonian mechanics, which turn out not to be right. And it tells us that if you go into the equations, it tells us that, it's not easy. That's a point. there's still a huge discussion among physicists and philosophers what exactly it means. And I think my take on it, and the entire book goes around this idea, what it's really telling us is that objects have only properties when they interact with other objects. So things don't exist by themselves. Nothing exists by itself. It's a relation between things that builds up the world. If we think about reality of individual things with properties, I don't know, particles with properties, object with properties, you just don't get it. We have to think that an object has a property only in interacting with something else. I think this is the core of at least this way of viewing quantum theory. And you see how deep it is, how just profound it is. It's just don't think about things. The world is not made by things.
Yeah. Well, this term relation and also connection, those two terms come up again and again in the book. And that's precisely what you do. You dive deep into what it might mean to be in relation to other things. And Philippa, I want to come to you here, because those of us who know your work know that you're deeply interested in quantum theory and multiple reality and the possibility of connections between those realities. And I think it's clear that Carlo's work would interest you, but perhaps you can tell me in your own words and give me a sense of why it interests you.
Well, I am interested in this. I've been interested in quantum physics since I first heard about it when I suppose I was at school, and I read, 50 years ago, a book by Banish Hoffman called The Strange Story of the Quantum, which made all sorts of things simultaneously clear and more difficult. Carlo is unusual in that he is a very skillful writer. And I came across an example of how good this book is. It's good in many ways. Can I just quote a couple of sentences? He's talking about information in quantum theory. Words, he says, are never precise. The variegated cloud of meanings that they carry about with them is their expressive power. Now, a few pages later, he's talking about our everyday experience and how difficult it is to understand what's going on down there. At the molecular scale, he says, for example, the cutting edge of a sharp knife is as fluctuating and imprecise as the edge of an ocean in a storm fraying upon the white sand of the shore. Now, that's a wonderful image in itself, but it's got embedded in it a little example of what he says in the previous sentence, how words are imprecise, their meanings leak. The word white refers to, in the second example, the white sand of the shore. But we look at that sentence in the way we normally read, not isolating words one at a time and thinking of them separately. But we look at that sentence, and the word white impresses itself upon us, because what do we think of? It's the white foam of the sea, the white spray of the water. So the meaning is sort of leaked out of it, and in fact, everything else. Things do connect, and sometimes in ways we don't expect them to. And words are a very good example of this. What I love about Carlo's work is that he is open to all these other examples of how things work, and simply what a good writer he is.
I wonder what you make of that, Carlo.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. It's very kind. Let me put it this way. When Heisenberg was on the island, he was a young physicist, right? Immersed into physics. He had been in Copenhagen and working with Bohr to get up to date with everything known at the time about the atoms, all the mysteries of the atoms, how the physics, the mechanics of the atoms work, which, you know, was puzzling the physicists of his generation. But he went there not just with that. First of all, he had poetry with him. He had Goethe, and was in fact spending his time doing calculation and in any spare moment learning by heart Goethe poems of the Western Eastern Divan. It's about Islam and Goethe love for Islam. And he had in his mind a lot of Mach philosophy. A good friend of Heisenberg was Pauli, whose father was a good friend of Mach. And the Pauli and Heisenberg had spent a lot of time discussing Mach philosophy. These were young kids which were immersed in science, but had a very large culture, philosophical, artistic, literary. And all this comes into this revolution. It's the same thing. That's, I'm deeply convinced in it. Science is not just about numbers and writing equations. It's about having, especially in these deep moments of rethinking the reality, it's about the capacity of creating new worlds, of imagining new worlds. Of course, then, you know, measurement, equations, and so on and so forth. So this is why, I mean, when I read the worlds that Philip creates and puts up together, of course, these are worlds of fantasy on the one hand, and they, you know, it's just a fantasy. But at the same time, they're talking to us, exactly like the white of the sun is telling us something more than just their immediate meanings. I think that that's what our culture is a continuous crisscrossing of ideas and meanings that are reused in different situations, and science uses all the cultural water in which it swims to do what science do, which is also explaining us and giving us tools for doing things, for real. So it's a mixture of being extremely concrete and extremely flexible and vague. But what works in all that is the connection, is the relations.
It's very apparent in the book, Carlo, that the work of quantum physics is not simply restrained to an academic or even a scientific discipline. It has literary, philosophical, theological, spiritual, perhaps even political consequence for you. And that's one of the great merits of the book. I want us to linger with the literary for a bit longer. Philip, perhaps I can ask you about this, because the Heisenberg story certainly has elicited several literary representations, not least Michael Frayn's Copenhagen. And I wonder why it is so attractive to literature.
The idea of going to an isolated, desolate, deserted desert island and there finding wisdom and coming back and telling you is a very attractive one. And Carlo describes it very well. I've never been to Helgoland, but it's a familiar name to me because of the weather forecast, the shipping forecast. When I was very young, it's a place that seemed to exist in the same kind of world as football clubs called the Queen of the South. And in other words, it was something which only existed on the radio. But Carlo describes it very well, this search for a difficult question, an almost impossible question. And where do you go? You go to the wildest, most desolate, empty place you can find. Carlo, I can't remember, was there also hay fever involved?
Yeah. The actual reason or excuse to go there was that Heisenberg suffered some strong allergy, and one of the advantages of an island without vegetation in the middle of the sea, of course, this is no pollen, so you don't suffer from allergy. But there's more. It was a tradition. It was believed to be the hiding place of a pirate, Helgoland, Storbrook, something like that, which little Heisenberg loved when a kid. I mean, German and Northern kids have the stories of pirates. It's typical there. So I can't imagine not this being one of the reasons for him to go to this sort of mysterious pirate place in the middle of the sea to concentrate to focus on his big mysteries on which he was working.
There are so many delightful quirks to the story, the hay fever being one. Philip, were you going to add something? Did I interrupt you?
No, merely that to be alone, to be in solitude with a problem to solve. It's not just Heisenberg, it's other people. I mean, you think of Newton at home in Lincolnshire because of the plague that was ravaging London, and while he was there with nothing else to do, he discovers the principle of gravitation and so on. So it's a kind of classic a classic image is going somewhere difficult in order to do something important and then returning different, changed. That resonates a great deal. It certainly makes me want to go to go to Helgoland and stay there for a while.
We should organise this trip. Look, who knows what would come of it?
So, well, something else occurred to me quickly then on the way through, and this was another connection between science and literature. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, author of course, Kubla Khan and The Ancient Mariner, said he used to go to the Royal Institution, where there were public lectures on science, or as they called it then, natural philosophy. He used to go to the lectures to renew his stock of metaphors, apparently. And I'm not the only writer who has helped himself gratefully to whatever he can find in the goodie bag of metaphors that science has provided for us. So thank you, science.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. I wonder if it works the other way for you, Carlo. I know literature matters to you. I wonder if literature facilitates your thinking about quantum theory. Perhaps you're not quite stealing metaphors from Philip's books, but does it? You certainly talk about Shakespeare and Dante in this book. So does literature enable your thinking about quantum theory?
Well, not directly, but indirectly, certainly, yes, because literature is an incredible way of exercising your mind to think about alternatives to what you see around yourself, right? And that's exactly what you need to do when you do science. I mean, we grew up with a simple story of what reality is. Well, reality is simple, right? There's a chair there, there's a table there, and that's it. Sky's there, the earth is down. And then you discover that this is just your little room. The universe is immense. And that's exactly the same profound feeling that you have when you read a story or a novel or for science fiction or fantasy. I mean, there are many possibilities in the world. And our universe, in fact, is nature has more imagination than us, in spite of everything, than all of us. I mean, which science writer could have really come out with incredible complication of a black hole with all its magic, right? So I do think that that there's a general influence, but then there's also very much stricter influence by philosophy in particular. I mentioned Heisenberg learning from Mach, a philosopher. In fact, his technical article starts with almost a quotation, a citation from Mach. But my book has a chapter of Nagarjuna, a Buddhist philosopher of the second century, and has a chapter about Lenin and Bogdanov, which are the heads of the Bolshevik party, at the time of the October Revolution in Russia. Not by love of, talk about strange things in a science book, because I do believe that ideas which are produced by these people do help us making sense of the strange, mysterious things which is quantum theory, which is still strange and mysterious. That's the beauty of it, right? My book is not, look, we have learned that the world works this way, I tell you how it is. My book is, look, we have learned something astonishing, quantum theory. We are still struggling to find some light in the darkness of what exactly it means. And this is where we are.
Philip, I know Nagarjuna, this second century Indian Buddhist thinker, is also an important touchstone for you. This is a shared interest that you have.
Well, I was fascinated to read about Nagarjuna because I hadn't come across his name before. I don't know very much about Buddhism or Indian philosophy or Eastern philosophy in general, but it does fascinate me. Maybe I'm just renewing my stock of metaphors in the way that Coleridge was stealing from things that tickled his fancy. The whole connection between body, mind, thought, speculation, the universe itself is a fascinating one. I'm particularly interested, and have been for a long time, in the nature of consciousness and what we can find out about that by scientific means and by other means. Can I read from Carlo's book again? There's a wonderful quotation he has here. I think he's quoting somebody else. However mysterious the mind-body problem may be for us, we should always remember that it is a solved problem for nature. It's us that are puzzled by these things. It's not that they're puzzling in themselves necessarily, but you have to look at it in a different way. That actually reminded me of the problem that we have, the enormous, insoluble, never-ending problem we have with finding an exact value for pi. Well, we can find billions and trillions of digits, but we never quite get there in the end, and it takes enormous computing power, and finally we have a whole book. But you draw a circle, you draw a line across the circle, and there it is. Geometry has solved it. It's there.
Very good. Very good. Very nice. Very nice.
The mind-body problem and many other things that we find almost insoluble now can be... Well, we can realize there is a solution, but we have to look at it in a different way, possibly.
I wonder what you think of that, Carlo. I was thinking about whether it is possible to talk about quantum theory as more than a theory. And following Philip's remarks there, can we think about how it affects our reality? Are we living it in some way?
We're certainly living it with its applications, right? If we can talk to one another through a computer right now, it's because, chips and integrated circuits have been built using quantum theory. So we're using it heavily in everyday life. But that's not what you're asking. You're asking whether the insights of quantum mechanics actually touch us. I think that the answer is they should. And maybe they haven't yet enough. Look, when Copernicus found out that Earth is not the center of the universe, Did the life of anybody change? Well, no. You know, people woke up in the morning and brush their teeth, the same as before. And when Darwin find out, Darwin is another one who went alone, was sort of alone, but went away in the wilderness with a beagle, with a boat around the world to find an incredible discovery that we are causing with all the other animals and plants. When that became clear, and it's clear, did our life change? Well, it didn't. You know, we do the same thing as before. But boy, we think about ourselves differently. We do things about ourselves differently, right? It changes completely the meaning of what we are. Just thinking that me and the tree have a common ancestor, which is cousins. And the same, I think, is true for quantum mechanics. If we think that to understand the world, science itself shouldn't work in terms of just individual object with properties, but the world is only comprehensible in how things relate to one another. This should be a general thing. So you talked about consciousness. The problem of consciousness is that we think about me as an entity, and you say, well, come on, how I can be made by little atoms bouncing around? This cannot be. But the point is that the atoms are not atoms. They're a relation between things. And I am not an entity. I'm a relation between things. When you start to reframing the things this way, it's, you know, like when Philip is saying, yeah, pi, you can do all this very long calculation that never ends, but you can also draw a circle to a line, and that's pi. So if you change the way the problem is formulated, and if you view it from a different perspective, things that seem to be problems for us disappears. And I think that consciousness is a typical thing that we're not going to solve. We're going to dissolve the problem. We're going to understand better the mind, and realize that it seems so hard to us because we try to frame it in the wrong language. And the quantum revolution, I think, help us in that. And reading Nagarjuna help us in that, because Nagarjuna is all about, you know, relations. Things don't exist by themselves, but they exist in relation to something else, depending on something else.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
I just want to come back to this idea that it is possible to not just think about quantum theory, but to experience it, to live it. And I wonder, Philip, if that's a way of understanding your work too, that your work is a kind of speculation about how quantum mechanics might be affecting our reality.
Well, I don't think I'm doing that deliberately. In fact, I'm fairly sure I'm not doing that deliberately, because I don't write for that sort of purpose. What I am interested in at the moment, extremely interested in, is the difference that is how you open up a limited point of view. In The Book of Dust, which I'm writing now, Lyra, my heroine, has been profoundly affected by two books of philosophy which have caused her to reject her imagination. She doesn't trust it anymore. And it's a question for me, how I can show her, opening her mind again to things that she's shut out deliberately. I think I'll get there in the end, but when I do find it, when Lyra finds an answer, it will have a great deal to do with this business of not just seeing something in isolation, but seeing the whole penumbra of associations, memories, hopes, fears, shadows of all sorts that lie around it. Nothing exists in isolation. This is why I'm so taken with Carlo's book, because it does demonstrate in another way the thing that I'm trying to write about in the third part of The Book of Dust, the fact that we are all part of a great network of meanings that go off in all directions. I mean, the meaning of something, the meaning of this pen, for example, for me, is that I write my novels with it. That's one of the meanings of this pen for me, and that's definitely part of how I see the pen. You couldn't examine that in sort of quantitative scientific detail, but you don't need to, because I'm telling you that's what the meaning is. So like that pen, and like Lyra in my story, you have to see yourself and everything in the world as being part of this network of connections, a kind of penumbra of other things that lie behind and aren't necessarily visible, but they're there, and they affect the way we live and the way we love things and the way we love each other. So I thank you, Carla, for giving us another picture of how this works, seeing it from another angle.
Well, first of all, we're all a little in love with Lyra, so we look forward to to seeing
her.
It's hard not to be. I very much recognize what you're saying. I think that is what is fascinating in your books. This penumbra, one might say wrongly, that it seems to be something that goes against enlightening, clear light, scientific picture of the world. I think that the reality is exactly the opposite. What a scientific picture of the world is to recognize that we see certain things, and there are so many things that we don't see yet, we are confused about, we are vague, because they are complicated, because they are complex, because they regard things happening inside ourselves that we don't know, because they regard aspects of the world we haven't understood yet. So science is not about what we know. It's about the boundary between what we know and what we don't know, and the mystery and the effort to try to understand. And it's a deep recognition. What science is realizing that what seems obvious to us might be wrong, and therefore that there might be a different perspective of things. Then scientists have all its methods, measuring equations and all that. But these are tools. The point is understanding something new. And to understand something new, very often the barrage is not the difficulty in itself. It's what we think we know. right? So we know that the Earth is flat. So why should we question it? Well, because it's wrong. and so realizing that there is this space of uncertainty surrounding us, everywhere, near us, inside us, it's a first step towards science, in my opinion.
I'm going to turn to our audience. We're getting so interesting. The first question, I mean, what's so interesting about the questions that I'm seeing here, Carlo and Philip, is that they can each be asked to both of you. Some of them are addressed to you, Carlo, and some of them are addressed to you, Philip, but I think it would be equally interesting to hear from both of you. So this is the first question. And it is, Heisenberg had his great insight when he was a very young man, as you mentioned, Carlo, in his 20s. You are somewhat more mature. Does age matter if you are a scientist? And it strikes me that we could also ask, does age matter if you are a writer? Carlo, you go first.
It's a fact that most greatest scientific results were obtained by young people. Not all of them. So, you know. People, old people like me can still hope a little bit to do something useful. But it's when you're young, you have a greater scientific creativity. There's no doubt about that. You need to be able to think different, to have courage, to revolt, to go against what you know. You need the flexibility you have when you're young.
Philip?
It's an interesting one, this, because in some ways it gets harder, not easier, to write because you see more different ways of saying the same thing. You perhaps used a similar construction in a previous book, but now you can see a better way of doing it. And which one do you use? It's not easy to choose always. But I always console myself with thinking that at least I'm not a ballet dancer or a footballer, because I can carry on writing even though my knees hurt me when I walk upstairs. If I were a footballer or a ballet dancer, I'd have had to stop a long time ago. But at least I can carry on doing that. It's curious, though, isn't it? We understand now, because we've seen several examples of mathematicians who do great work when they're very young, chess players too, and musicians. Now, I wonder, Carlo, do you think, is that something to do with abstract pattern recognition? Is there something common to chess and mathematics and music which does involve abstract pattern recognition? Because we don't often have a very young novelist. I mean, a young novelist would be an absolute, a freak, a monstrosity. You need to know a bit about the world before you write a novel.
Yeah, I mean, to do creative work, you need such a combination of skills. And of course, some are natural when young, but some are come with the amount of knowledge you have. And so I guess that growing older, on the one hand, we lose courage. On the other hand, we gain perspective. We have seen so many wrong things that we can avoid wrong things. And sometimes we get a wider view of things. That's no doubt. But that's good because the world is made by young and old people, so they can collaborate.
Yeah. The next question, again, I think it could apply to both of you. It's such a good question. In fact, I wish I'd asked it. What is the most useful question to ask yourself to understand or explore time and space better? So what is the most useful question to ask yourself to understand or explore time and space better? What do you think, Carlo?
I don't know, but that's
the right question.
No, that's the right question because once again, doing science is not about finding the right questions. It's finding the right answers. It's to find the right questions, right? It's sometimes I think, what should I ask if I met God or I met somebody in the next 10 millennia who know all many things of it? That's not the point. I mean, I should ask him what should I ask? Okay, what could I tell a scientist of the past, useful for him? I mean, not one of the answers of the question that he was posing. So stop posing that question. The interesting question is another one.
What about you, Philip? I wonder if when you were writing his Dark Materials, if there was a question that you were asking yourself, or do you ask yourself questions?
But they're never of a grand kind, like, what is the nature of time and space and how can I elucidate it in this next paragraph? it's questions like, what's she wearing? Where's the light coming from? Where are they speaking to each other? What is he drinking? What's in his glass? That sort of thing. I like to think that, well, I have a sort of little catechism of questions that I mentally run through when I'm writing a scene, which are things like that. Where are we? What do I see? What would, if I were there, what would I see if I looked around? What's the weather like outside the window? Is it raining? Is it sunny? These things all have a bearing on, well, they're all connected, as Carlo says, we're all connected. They're all part of the kind of whole picture that you're going to, that you're trying to paint. And I say it in those terms, picture and paint, because a lot of it is a visual thing. We know how the cinema works now, for example, and we know the difference between a close-up and a wide shot. And we use close-ups and wide shots when the cinema would need to use them. You know, if you want to establish where you are, you have a wide shot. If you want to see what he's passing her under the table, you have a close-up. And all these little techniques, I like to know what the reader would see if they were present at the scene. So I try and focus on the most important things and do those. Questions of time, space, fate, destiny, immortality, all those things, they can look after themselves. For me, I'm more interested in what she's wearing and what he's carrying in his pocket.
I love that answer. Now, there is a question here which follows on slightly, and perhaps I asked it earlier too, about how the concept of dust in His Dark Materials reflects science's understanding of reality or quantum theory. And perhaps I can bend that question a little bit to ask about your research process. Are there particular things that you read and watched to inform yourself about that aspect of the series, Philip?
Yeah, well, I have a sort of motto which I've stolen from Muhammad Ali, that great poet Muhammad Ali, dance like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Well, my motto is read like a butterfly, write like a bee. I read like a butterfly. I go from here to there. I don't have a systematic procedure at all. I read anything I find interesting. And when it stops being interesting, I put the book down and pick up another book or go somewhere else. So I don't have, I'm not working as a systematic person of letters would be. I'm not gathering information and doing research and then systematizing it and putting it all together and writing that's not how I work. It's very much butterfly and bee. The bee part comes when I'm in my little room, the room I'm in now, and I'm sitting down at the table with my pen in my hand and trying to make honey from the multitude of pollen particles and nectar that I picked up. So I keep telling myself, this is not a court of law. I am not on oath. I have not sworn to tell the truth and nothing but the truth. I'm telling a story. And anything I use in anything I have found out in the course of reading Carlo's book or books of biography or history, anything I use is therefore to help me get the scenery right. I couldn't write a book about quantum physics, but I don't need to because Carlo has.
Yeah. Carlo, there's a question here about how you are a scientist, but you have also been called a philosopher and a poet. I don't know how you feel about that. But the question is, how do you see yourself?
We all struggle to give an identity to ourselves. And I've done the same mistake, and I keep thinking, oh, but I'm a scientist. I'm not something else. So I try to think of myself as a scientist. In fact, I'm not writing now. I'm doing calculations about black holes. But, you know, we are many things at the same time. Each of us is all sort of different things at the same time. So, and we change. We're not one thing. We, every day in our life, redesign us and make us something different. So obviously, writing books and what comes around has added things to me. We're all layers of identities. I'm not a writer in a specific sense. I was listening very carefully, Philip, to what you were saying. That's exactly what I'm not capable of doing, right? I cannot tell a story which is seen in two persons in a room talking to one another and say what happened in a convincing way. I cannot make it up, because the only thing I can do is do the opposite. Start from an idea and look for the world, for the words to try to express it. So in one sense, I'm not a writer at all. I would never be able to write a novel. I think we're doing something similar in describing realities, describing worlds, but also something very different in the actual process. And I have a question. Do you really write with a pen?
yes, I've written with this pen for many, many years.
Fantastic.
Recently, until recently, I've got rheumatism now in my hand. It's rather difficult to write to hold the pen properly, so I'm now writing on the keyboard on the screen, which I don't like as much. But I like writing with a pen because it's silent, because it's environmentally sound. I don't use up any carbon, and also because I can see what I've just written and I can cross it out, but it's still there and I can go back to it. And also because it's quite difficult to keep correcting it. The screen makes it too easy to correct what you've just done. You can chuck the whole paragraph out and start again, which is quite tempting to do. But with a pen, you can't do that. So this is a better instrument for me to write books with. But, anything would do.
So you have to think before writing a lot.
Yeah, but things also come to you as you write. But this is, there's a ritual involved as well. There are elements of magic involved here and superstition.
Of course.
And this pen is essential, and using the right sort of paper is important as well. Simply because I've been doing it for 50 years and it works. I know it works. So why would I want to do something else?
What about you, Carlo? Is there any part of your work that you do in the old-fashioned way with a chalk on a blackboard? Are you calculating things by hand, or is it all entirely computer operated and algorithmic?
No. When I do science, it's a notebook and a pen. Of course, I'm usually lying on a sofa and writing and calculating, and once in a while looking in some papers or something. But writing for me, it has been since the very beginning computer writing, because I write a paragraph, I change it, I rewrite it, I change every word 12 times, I go back, it's completely in its constant evolution. In a way that I would not be able to do it in. I'm a very slow writer, in fact. I keep going back and rewriting. And of course, I have all sort of magic and rituals. I'm totally incapable of giving a talk, public talk, online or for real, if before that I don't walk out, find a tree, go near a tree, touch the tree, look at it and get inspired by it. And then it relaxes me, give me power, strength. I go back, I'm smiling, I'm happy, and I can do it.
That's so beautiful. That's a lovely thing to share. What are your rituals, Philip? Do you go kiss a tree before giving papers?
apart from the pen, the right pen and the right paper, I'm surrounded by a host of different little special things. I've got my length of carbon fiber rod, which I use both to switch on and off my fan, which keeps me cool, and also to scratch my back. I've got piles and piles and piles, piles and piles of books, including the one indispensable thing, which is this one. It's an old dictionary. I like this one because I can pick it up with one hand, and it's got etymologies in it as well. And here's a piece of equipment from a dark matter detector, which was given to me by the scientists at the Diamond Lab, who invited me there one day. And this is very precious to me because it's gone cloudy, so they can't use it. So they gave it to me. And so I now use it as a paperweight. And when I finish writing during the day, I put this on it so it can go on detecting dark matter while I'm asleep. And so on, all sorts of superstitions and rituals. Yes.
We're talking, this is so fascinating. I always find the backstage gossip about how writers and thinkers work so fascinating. But we're talking about more than superstition. We're talking about a kind of magic. So is there magic to quantum theory? Is there magic to this? This isn't just a pure science. There is something still quite mystical here, isn't there, Carlo?
Look, I am a hardcore materialist, naturalist, atheist, scientist, all the worst thing you can put together. I see no contradiction whatsoever between that and me going kissing a tree before a talk and all these magics. And the world magic is a very wide world, because what does it evocate? It evocates a sense of wonder and lightness and incomprehensibility, which is not something science avoids. It's something that science is motivated by. Science is very good in unmasking the magic, which is false magic. right? It's very good of saying, look, that's impossible. It's truly impossible. It's wrong. But there are so many things, especially all things related to the way we ourselves work and think, is there anything scientific proving that it's not true that going out in a tree calms me down and put me in the right? No, of course. So, yes, I think that I can be a scientist, a hard scientist all the way through and have nothing in contradiction with all that.
Philip, I wonder how you where you stand with this question of magic, the mystical and quantum theory.
Well, my feeling is that it's a good thing to be capable of believing contradictory things simultaneously. I've always felt happier in the kind of the twilight where you can't quite see whether something's true or not. And it doesn't really matter because you're in the twilight as well. And this is where interesting things happen. The famous quotation, which I've often referred to from Keats, he talks about something called negative capability. That's when you're in a state of capable of being in a state of doubt, uncertainty and mystery without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. This state of mind, which is very well described in poetry, not only in Keats's poetry, but also in the poetry of Wordsworth, and many of the Romantic poets, is a very productive state of mind. And you have to be prepared to accept contradictions. William Blake was good on this, and a line from him came to my tongue a moment ago and then vanished again, so I can't give it to you. But it's the state where many things can be true at once. That's the state that I like to get into. And do I think it's true? No. And yes.
Perfect. Perfect answer. Carlo, go on, you're going to say something.
I share Philip's views about these things, and I'm not the only one. One of the greatest scientists of the 20th century, in fact, one of the fathers of quantum mechanics, is Niels Bohr, who has been one of the deep thinkers. And one of the things he loved to repeat is the following sentence, that a deep truth is a truth such that the opposite truth, it's also true, and is also a deep truth. Now, I think this is an extraordinarily useful way of thinking about ourselves and about the scientific enterprise. And also that there is a subtle line, a delicate line, but important line, in separating this with the bad use that the penumbra that Philip was mentioning is sometimes being used. And quantum physics has been subject to so much misuse. I mean, there are people selling medicines calling quantum medicine. There are, associations using quantum this and quantum that, pretending that since everything is connected, this also can be true. What you know, it might be true. And it's just charlataneria, we say in Italian. It's just bullshit, we say in America. I don't know how you say it in the UK. It's just nonsense. And it's more than nonsense. It's bad. So distinguishing the confusion, which is just misusing ideas where we do have some clarity, it's important from the actual confusion that is protected, this is important. It shouldn't go neither in one direction or the other. So our being afraid of misuses of idea should not, of misuse of this uncertainty, this penumbra, should not make us afraid of the penumbra itself, because that's where creativity and new ideas may come from. And that's where we live. We live in uncertainty.
Exactly. And one important aspect of our personality, one of the gifts we have, is a sense of humour, which is the same as a sense of proportion in some way. Was it Niels Bohr who had a horseshoe nailed up above his laboratory door? And they said, you don't believe in that, do you? And he said, no, of course not. But they tell me it works whether you believe in it or not. Now, that's a very good joke. And he was showing exactly what I meant by that, a sense of proportion. You can be half in and half out and laugh at yourself and laugh at everybody. It's that sense of humour is profoundly important. It's a profoundly good way of looking at the world, I think, if you can kind of laugh at it and yourself at the same time.
I want to pose one last question from the audience. I'm so sorry to the audience if I haven't managed to reach your questions. I've done my best to squeeze in as many as we can. We started with the question of youth and the genius of youth. This question asks about age, I think. The work of a lot of great scientists get overturned during the course of time. Do you believe that your own work will endure? And I think that's an interesting question to ask both of you. How do you feel about that, Philip, about the future of your work? Posterity.
I don't really think about that very much, but if I did, I would be consoled by the fact that you cannot disprove a novel. If I'd spent my life working at a scientific problem and came to what I thought was a proof and solved it, I would, and then somebody came along and disproved, turned it over, I'd be, what have I done all that work for? But you can't disprove a novel by writing a review of it.
Yes.
So my books will still be there on the shelf. Whether anybody reads them is another question altogether, but the books will be there as long as the libraries are there.
Carlo?
Well, first of all, I don't think good science is overturned. Newton has not been overturned. We have made step ahead, and what has been overturned is the false idea that Newton has got to the bottom of the story. He didn't, but the importance of his work is still monumental, immense, and all the statues of Newton are appropriately there still. First, second, I don't know. My own work in science is a bit different because I don't know whether a lot of the things I've done will be proven, not even less disproven. So who knows what's going to happen in the future. But as far as my concern for posterity, it's much less than what anybody might think. I don't believe in posterity. I mean, so what? I mean, some generation in the future, humankind will disappear and everything will be lost. That's it. We live for the present. We don't live for the future. And we build for the future because we care about our children and so on and so forth. But I think it's a cheat. We're afraid of death, so we want to be mortal through what we do. I mean, who cares? We are mortal, and we should appreciate our mortality, not trying to cheat it into an immortality of some other kind.
Thank you so much. I think this conversation could go on. We have to reunite you in person at a pub in Oxford, perhaps with fewer beers, so we remember the content of the conversation. But it's been so delightful eavesdropping into your thinking and your rapport. And thank you, Carlo Rovelli and Philip Pullman, and to you, our audience, for these really tremendous questions, and of course the team at Intelligence Squared who've kept us to time. For now, I'm going to thank Carlo and Philip again and hand back to Hannah from Intelligence Squared.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.